The Truth About ASPs. We have Diana Kelly and Ian Poynter. Diane Kelly is with Lockstar Development, an internet security company. Ian is with Jerboa Incorporated, an internet security consultancy. Together, they have over 20 years' experience. I'd like to welcome you to the conference.
Naomi's going to get to find out if this works, right?
Is it working?
Okay.
All right, you sit.
I'll take this off here.
There you go. Oh, yeah, that's right. We can walk around. Sorry about this. So the truth about ASPs, trusting strangers with your business data. We got this idea to do this talk because we had a lot of clients that were starting to outsource things to ASPs without even beginning to think about the security issues that were surrounded with the trust of going out to an ASP. And we got really curious as to what is going on with the ASPs and should our clients actually outsource their trust to them. And as we started to investigate, we learned some very interesting things. There's nothing wrong. ASPs don't have a bad model. They didn't go out and in any way try and break your trust or put your data at risk. It's just ASPs have a particular interest, which is to do the business. And looking at the security of the business was not the first idea on their mind. Things are starting to normalize and get a little bit better. And the purpose of this talk is to really help you to educate yourselves about what you're getting into if you're going with an ASP, what you need to think about, and what the ASP needs to help you understand about their own processes and procedures.
I actually come at this slightly from a different angle. I've started to do some work with ASPs that actually are thinking about security, in addition to customers that are merely outsourcing everything without thinking about it. So I'm sort of coming at it from both angles. I don't know whether there's anyone here from an ASP, but it would be certainly very interesting to compare notes later.
Could we get a hand showing of anybody with
ASPs?
An ASP?
ASPs? Are there any ASPs here?
Okay.
Yes, we've got a few. Okay.
You came to hear if we were going to say something bad.
Hopefully we won't be victimizing your particular companies, but I can't guarantee that. This is us, in case you need to contact us. Certainly, we're open to questions both now and after the session and some random time in the future when you can think of something you didn't think of. I'd also like to point out that I'm wearing a historical shirt because I bought this from Boo.com just before they went under. So anyone who wants to come and touch it to feel a piece of e-commerce failure is welcome to come up after the presentation.
You can also smell his nice cologne.
So. Oh, thank you.
Not also, purchased at Boo.com.
No, not purchased at Boo.com. I'd like to get some idea of what kind of an audience we have here today. And so I want to ask a few sort of random questions so that I can see, or we can see, roughly what sort of audience we have. How many of you consider yourselves to be primarily technical people? And how many of you are on the other end of the scale and consider yourselves to be primarily business people? Okay. This is good. It's nice to know that we've got some of each.
And this is primarily a business discussion. It's not
although you know, the tendency of those of us that are business people and techies is to delve into technical stuff as well. So for those of you that are business people, and we start saying things that you don't understand for some reason, wave your hands around. The light's kind of dim in here, so you need to wave your hand instead of just putting it up, and we'll gladly explain anything that needs to be explained. So just to confirm that we're all on the same page with this, we start out with what is an ASP anyway. Actually, this is trickier than you would think, because now if you say you're an ASP and you've sort of got a business model that might make a profit soon, then VCs are going to shower you with kisses, although that's probably going to last about another 3 months. So a lot of people are saying they're ASPs when they used to be something else or used to call themselves something else. To us, an ASP obviously stands for Application Service Provider, which I'm sure most of you have come across. We see it as outsourcing taken to an extreme, in the sense that you're not only outsourcing a particular part of your business operations, but you're also outsourcing your business data. You're giving your data to someone else. So it's taken to a logical conclusion.
People have been doing some outsourcing of their business data, before. Like, if you look at your payroll, it goes out to ADP or it's Paycheck. So you have outsourced some trust. A lot of people have outsourced some trust to VeriSign when they do part of their certificates. So it's not a completely. If you look at consultants or specialists, you've outsourced some of the trust, some of your internal data to, say, a legal team or an accounting team. That is your business data that they handle. But generally, there's a face that you can put on it, or in the case of payroll, it can be differentiated from personally some of the identifiable information inside the company. This is very different. This is going out to some provider on the internet, depending on which model you're going under, depending on whether you're using a slice of one of their applications, a slice of their server, or something like that. So it's a very different face to outsourcing trust than people have seen in the past.
It's also important to make the distinction between just outsourcing a function and outsourcing trust. What you're doing with an ASP is that you're not just selling your IS department to IBM and then having all the same people stay there and just get paychecks from someone else. What you're doing is you're outsourcing some level of trust to some people that you most likely have never met before. Now, actually, if you take a step back from that and think about it from a personal point of view, it makes a lot of people a lot more nervous when they're outsourcing trust that's about themselves or their own personal data. But what you have to remember here is that a lot of this data that's getting outsourced is personal data that belongs to other people that you are holding in trust. So there are some important things to consider here, and as Diana said, these aren't technical issues. They become technical issues, but they are, like so much in security, really people issues and business issues. And that's something that is, I think it gets lost on a lot of people in the rush to rid themselves of some nasty business function that they don't actually want to have to manage and maintain. So what we're trying to do is to get everybody to take a step back before they do this. We're not saying don't do it. We just want you to take a step back and say, am I doing something really stupid here that I'm going to regret later? Or am I doing something very sensible and adding business value and doing all the things that everybody that's going to buy your stock wants to hear?
Yeah, and to take really stupid to recast that maybe too, am I doing something that doesn't make business sense? A lot of people will go to an ASP for an ERP solution or for a CRM solution. If you're going out to an ASP because, say, you don't want to buy something like an Onyx to do all of your CRM and your customer support, so you say, okay, I'm going to go out to an ASP because I can't afford the whole suite of the solution for the software, and I can't afford to get the folks inside to support it. Balance that against what it would cost your company if all of your customer support information about your clients and tracking the bugs in your software or tracking what's going on within your company, if that were exposed to a competitor or to somebody who could do something malicious with it. Weigh the cost benefit. It may be you're being penny wise and pound foolish.
There's quite a lot of penny wise and pound foolish in business in general, so this is not a new problem. But it is a problem that impinges directly, for those of us that are technical folks, on the way in which these things have to be secured and the way in which we have to think about them. And that's a little different. It's interesting to look at other aspects of the computer industry, and of course, being security weenies, we look at security aspects of things. There's always the buzzword of the month. I call it the Wall Street Journal School of Management. A prime example of that is the VPN. First of all, the virtual private network means something very different to each person that you talk to and to each company that's trying to sell one. Secondly, VPNs became the buzzword of the month some period of time ago. It's hard to always pinpoint the beginnings of these things. But once it was buzzword of the month, you've got CEOs and other people that probably should be more technically savvy than they are because of the way that business is becoming more e-business. But at the same time, they're reading about VPNs and they come to the CTO, or worse, they come to the low-level IS people and they're like, we don't have one of these VPN things. We really need one. Everyone else has one. We've got to get one. So someone goes out to get a VPN. And why, without necessarily considering what they're going to do with it or anything else, ASPs are one of those buzzwords right now. Everybody says, well, we could get an ASP solution. And in some cases, that might be the right thing to do. But in other cases, these people are making a decision based on herd mentality, which in the security arena makes us all sort of cold, clammy, and get sweaty hands. But a lot of the people that are making these decisions are not security people, and they don't think about security. And it's our job as security people to make them think about it. But unfortunately, it's kind of like telling someone, well, you really need to brush your teeth and floss, and you really need to get life insurance in these circumstances, and they switch off. So there's a struggle from the technical side of trying to explain why we should or shouldn't do these kinds of things, and this is not new. The solutions to these problems are similar to the solutions to other similar problems that we've all come across before.
Yeah, the sales pitch is really seductive coming from the ASPs, and I don't mean to be negative. I mean, that's the right thing to do. If you're an ASP, you are giving people a lot of benefit for them coming to you. They don't have to get all of the support inside internally. They don't have to hire the people to manage the solution. They can put that all out to the ASP. So it is a very seductive sale, but don't be too seduced. Really ask the hard question about what are they really going to offer, what kind of liability, and some of the questions that we're going to come up with here.
Now, what we're going to do now, the ASPs that we specifically mentioned here, we haven't singled them out because they have problems. We've just singled them out as examples of different types of ASP outsourcing and the models of what these people are doing. You may or may not have heard of these. We're just going to mention each one, and we'll talk a little bit about what it is they're doing, just so that you've got a framework.
Yeah, because if you're not familiar with ASPs, it is a bit of a garbage pail term, as Ian was saying, with VPNs too. You know, you can Sprint calls if you're dialing from your house with a regular, you know, voice call POTS is a Sprint VPN now. So this is just an example of what some of the ASPs out there are.
Yeah, Agilion is a contact management company. I actually looked at their tools because they have really interesting tools, and contact management is one of these things that, when a company is growing very rapidly, it gets to be a big problem. The contact management software that's out there is not perhaps what you want it to be, and they have some cool stuff. So I emailed to their customer support and said, "What do you do about security?" And they said, "Well, we've been audited by Ernst & Young." That was the security answer, and I pushed harder, and I said, you know, what does that really mean? They sent me to a page where I could go and look at the Ernst & Young attestation, which is a document that they used to have to send away for, and now you can see on the web that says, "We, Ernst & Young, check this out, and we think it's secure." And it was 6 months old, and that, whether or not Ernst & Young did a good job, I don't know, because it's hard to find out whether they did a good job or not. Whether they did what I would have done if I were auditing it, I don't know that either. But I do know that 6 months is a hell of a long time in the internet industry, and probably everything they tested has changed since then. So I actually love the tools, but you know, I'm a security company. I'm dealing with all this data that our customers would be very, very upset if it got into the hands of anybody, not just their competitors. And some of that goes into our contact database. And so I said, well, can I buy this and host it myself? No, we're an ASP. We don't do that. And so I had to walk away from something that was a really cool tool. So, you know, I don't know whether they've changed since then. This was a little while ago. But they're an interesting example of how some of the ASPs treat this.
Yeah, and audits and attestations are a good point. There is nothing wrong with folks that have been audited and attested to. And the Big Five do their checklist. They go through. This is something you want to know, that your ASPs or company that you're doing business with, you want your bank to be SAS 70 approved. However, it's not a be-all and an end-all, because the second that audit is done and the auditor walks away, that's the limit, because what they just audited can change. The software can change, the environment can change, the security model is going to change within that environment. So it's just, yes, audits and attestations have a place and they should be done, but no, they're not a silver bullet, and yeah, they certainly age very quickly. So 6 months right. Or a year is a long time.
The best audit in the world proves something at a single point in time, which is when the audit is done and they've signed off on it, and even before they've done the documentation of it, when they walk out the door and the audit is over in terms of the on-site portion of it, that's the point at which the audit means something. After that, there's a degradation, and one of the things you have to ask yourself is how quickly are things degrading? Recovery Solutions were very interesting. I've actually done an on-site visit with them as part of working with a customer. They work primarily in the Northeast right now in the U.S. They do remote backups, which scared the shit out of me the first time I heard that. One of the things that makes them a little bit different is that they allow you to encrypt your backups and they put you in control of the encryption. So if you're stupid, you can send your backups over the internet in the clear. Stupid may be a strong word, but you know. But you can control the encryption. Now the downside of that is if you lose the keys, you've lost your backups. And they back up their backups and they have other, you know, they have a lot of stuff going on, and the on-site visit was very entertaining. But it's an interesting, remote backup is an interesting model, because anyone who's ever worked as an administrator knows that backups are the devil's tool from hell, second only to modems. And consequently, everyone wants to outsource backups. They're all like, oh my God, this is so great, I can do this, I can push it all off onto someone else, I never have to touch a tape again in my life. And they're so excited that they just don't even think about it. Now, I'm not saying that it's not a bad thing, because I think backups are the devil's instrument from hell, and I hate them too. But you need to think carefully about what that really means in business terms. It's your turn to talk about eCal. Yeah,
the company's I know. Calendaring, there's a company out there called eCal. They go through the Go network, and they allow you to keep your calendar online, which is, great. You can put your calendar. I don't know how many people want to have their entire schedule public, but I'm not one of them. And they will do this for group calendaring and, within your organization calendaring, company calendaring, and it is offered right now through, it's a sticky thing at portal sites, but they are rolling it out to businesses. They do offer it, though. They, unlike Agilion, they do offer that you can buy the server and put it inside your company as well, so you can actually get their tool without having to share your schedule up over the internet. Storage, which is a little bit similar to the backup concept, right. But you can access it. It's the sale for iDrive is, hey, you get terabytes of storage, which is great here at our site remotely, and now you're going back and forth and pulling your data. It's cool if you're just storing things that like pictures of red pandas that you don't care if people see, but if you're storing anything that is proprietary or you need to keep secret, you better be storing it encrypted and sending it encrypted.
What's interesting about the remote storage is that a lot of these things are tightly integrated into Windows, so that you have a drive letter that's remote on the internet, which means if you're dealing with naive users who see this terabytes worth of storage that you've just given them, they don't have any conception at all for what's going on under the hood, and nor should they. That's why it's so convenient and so tempting. But what it means is that someone somewhere needs to make a decision, either to put policies in place and enforce them to keep the people from putting the wrong stuff there, which is pretty much impossible, or you have to make sure that when stuff is stored, that it's actually going to be stored securely in a way that fits in with your security policies and your model. I mean, there are a ton of other ASPs. I've been looking at one called iSend, which is backed by Pitney Bowes, that's a secure document delivery, which is making all the law firms hot under the collar, because it integrates with a document management system called iManage that a lot of them use. And I've been sort of digging into that. I'm actually in the process of doing that right now. And sometimes getting security information out of these guys is like, it's worse than pulling teeth. It's like pulling teeth and asking to do a root canal at the same time. They're really reticent. These guys have actually, iSend have been pretty good so far, but I haven't gone very far along that path. So here is what we're going to cover in this session, and again, we're only too happy to have people steer the conversation by asking us questions as we go along. We'll have a question and answer session at the end, but this is about information transfer. It's not just about us being talking heads. So we want to hear your questions as we move along. Yeah. For customers, we want you to know what are the kinds of questions you should be asking the ASPs and that you should be asking yourself.
And for any ASPs here, these are questions that we found our customers needed to have answers. And as we started working with ASPs, these are the questions that they were working through themselves in order to be able to really provide a full, secure service.
This is our first question of the day. I'm sure we can all collectively come up with some more questions that we haven't asked yet. I'm constantly adding to my list of things that you need to ask an ASP. One of them is, this is a tricky one because longevity in the current marketplace it's a very difficult thing to deal with. Very often the coolest, most interesting, most exciting, most diverting ASP solutions are the ones that come from companies that were founded in 2000. So there are some very interesting issues that you have to deal with in terms of how long does someone have to have been in business in order for you to consider them as someone that you want to do business with. And the answer to this question will change depending on who you are. If you're IBM, your way of dealing with this, if you're the federal government, your way of dealing with this is very different than if you're a three-person startup. Customer references are gold dust. This is one of the reasons that ASPs are throwing themselves at people to become reference customers in exchange for getting a really good deal. Everybody wants reference customers. It's the number one thing that everybody is always asking for. So you may be able to cut a really good deal with an ASP that wants you to be a reference customer. And at the same time, you should be asking yourself, why do they want me to be a reference customer and who are their other reference customers?
Right, and longevity is, you know, again, it's a balance, right? Because there are some ASPs out there that have been in business for 6 months because they're doing something new and no one else has ever done it before. So you're not going to find somebody who's been doing it for 6 years. That's part and parcel of what's going on here. So in that point, customer references really matter. And also, you can take a look, you can look at longevity in another way, which is what's the pedigree of this company? Who started it? Who are the people that are there? Because although this idea and this particular solution may not have been around for a long time, it could well be that the folks that are involved in it have been around for a long time and been doing stuff that you know, or they have references from people that have worked with them in other instances.
I work a lot with law firms, and one of my law firm customers, one of the attorneys, said to me, well, actually what I want to know is how much money and insurance do they have if I need to sue them? That was his first question, and you may not necessarily want to approach it in that way, but it does move on to some of the other things that we talk about liability insurance and various other things. But pedigree matters. Yeah. Who funded them matters. A lot of things matter when it's a young company.
Yeah, I was just thinking of a pedigree story. When one of the VCs that invested, is anybody here familiar with Gardant? Gardant? No? Okay. It's a security services company that just got millions of dollars worth of venture capital funding, and it was founded by the guys who did Razorfish and iCube. You know about Razorfish and iCube? No? Okay. Very successful web development content company. And the VC called me up and said, what do you think? And I said, well, in security, there are different kinds of models. What's their profit model? Blah, 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 blah. And I said, and what's their background? He said, well, they don't have any in security, but they figured they can learn it. And I said, really? What are you basing that on? And he said, well, because they were very, very successful with Razorfish and iCube, and they didn't know web development. Of course, nobody did a few years ago. And I said, okay, well, they got the money. In that case, and you know, I hope it's going to be a very successful company. In that case, it's a good example of somebody who took pedigree and passed as a good proof point.
In defense of Guidant, because I know people that work there, they did take some of their money and acquire a security consulting division of another company that brought with it some people with a serious security pedigree. So, but it was just a little unnerving to hear security being treated like you could go down to Sears and buy it. Which is something that I think a lot of us have run into. And those of you that are business people rather than technical people should learn real quick, if you want to do well in the security field, that you can't go out and buy security in a packet and sprinkle it over stuff like magic dust. This is something that those of us that are in the industry know implicitly. But I spend a lot of my time telling people this because I find that a lot of people are very naive about what security really means. This is the thing that all the technical people probably don't want to hear, but sorry.
Who's cringing at the word policy?
Yeah, hands up, who's cringing? This is a sad truth. It's one of those things. This is one of those things, actually, if you take a step back into more general security, security policy is another one of these mantras that everyone learns. Well, we need a security policy. But most people really don't have any idea what should be in it or what it is or how to write one or how to know a good one when they see it or how to pick holes in one when they see it. But even one paragraph written down on a piece of paper that everyone in the company has actually agreed to and understands is better than nothing at all.
Right. If you ask, is there a security policy, and they say a what or no, that's definitely a red flag for you to think about it. It's like anybody who does software development, you know, if you say, is a product QA'd? Yeah. Can I see the test plan? There's no test plan. Product wasn't QA'd. Same sort of thing. If they don't have a security policy, you can bet there are going to be some vulnerabilities at that company.
The other question then is, you know, if you have one of these mythical security policies, I was years ago giving a class about just security in general, and we talked about policies, and this one guy was just really not happy. And I went up to him in the break and I said, you know, you're really not happy. What's the problem? He said, well, I used to work at the Air Force writing security policies, and then we would go around to see what people were doing with them, and most people were using them as monitor stands and door stops because they were policies that were this thick sideways. No one ever read them, and no one ever took them and turned the policies into procedures that actually talked about what we need to do in order to ensure that we're meeting our policy. And that's something that I always ask people with policies is, okay, and what do you do with them? Do you doorstop with them or do you do something else?
Yeah, there's actually, I got on speaking twice today, but I'm doing the privacy talk later on in the day, and that actually steps through turning, it's from policy to technology, and it really steps through taking people from a policy that you've written into helping it become a procedure that gets upheld.
And you need to look at how they're actually ensuring that their policies are being followed as well. That, you know, people write policies and procedures and then everyone just ignores them and does what they want. Which is, you know, I mean, that's a natural human tendency, but that's not acceptable when you're the person whose data they're doing it with.
Right.
Here actually had a question.
Oh, sorry.
What if you ask it, why they have a policy on the table?
Well, the question was, if you ask a provider if they have a policy and they say yes, what can you really do to verify it? Well,
ask for it.
Yeah, you need to actually see it. Because if you're going to be a customer of theirs, they should trust you enough that even if you have to sign something to say you're not going to like take it and put it in a book and sell it, you need to actually see it. And, well, the problem is that if you're not someone who really understands what you're looking at, you need to take a step back and admit to yourself that you don't know what you're looking at and have someone else look at it for you.
As a customer, you should be allowed to see their policy. You don't necessarily, you know, if their policy contains very private information like passwords, that's not necessarily something they need to share with you. I don't know why it would, but you should definitely be allowed to take a look at the policy. You should have a mutual NDA with them, and they should let you take a look at it. Something that we just briefed over here could you go back, Ian?
Oh, sorry.
The customers should be allowed to also influence into the ASP itself. So we make a point of, if you have a policy within your organization, if your company has a security policy, make sure that that extends out to the ASP. This is your corporate enterprise data that the ASP is probably managing, so make sure that they're going to uphold your own corporate policies as well. Share your policies with them. And if you look at their policy and it says something that doesn't, say their backups are out of the range for the time that you back up, or, you know, their password aging is out of the range, something like that. They should be flexible enough to hear what you have to say and perhaps take your suggestions to change it.
Now, there was someone in the back of the question and somebody here.
Yeah, you're supposed to make sure that it's not possibly required in the policy, whether internal.
Right.
Yeah, we get to the
that's
audit.
That's on the next slide.
Yeah.
You said you should make sure they've been audited against the policy.
A lot of times you can do walk through the site and just reference the policy.
Yeah. See, take the policy, do a site visit, and look at the policies and even the procedures, and see whether or not, you know, if they say that everybody has to use a card to get into the computer room and the door's propped open with a book, then you know that they're not following what they said they were going
to
do.
Yeah, we've got two. I think you had a question first.
Yeah.
Yes, I did. Scott Barber, Secure Network Consultant. What are you finding when you're preparing for this presentation that these ASPs are using for compliance management software?
What are ASPs using for compliance management software? I'm finding that most of them are shooting from the hip right now, but that's, you know.
Yeah.
if you want brutal honesty, which is what I usually get paid to. Right.
Well, SAS 70 is, yeah, that's an audit that a SAS 70 auditor needs to complete. But as far as monitoring compliance software for the standard, the startup ASPs, they're getting their business models out there, and security is really coming as an afterthought. And they just have not, most of them have not built security, and they don't have monitoring.
Oh, maybe there's a market
for compliance.
There.
Most of them don't.
It
depends on the company, and we of course don't know every single ASP on the planet, but really the majority of what we've seen has been that folks are now starting to bring ISPs are ahead of the game, right? They've been in business for a long time. They've had the problems with the reliability, so they know what it takes to stay up and stay running, but the ASPs are just starting to learn a lot.
I mean, since we're in Vegas, I suppose I should bet. I'd be prepared to bet money, real money, that 95% of ASPs don't use anything at all, and that the other 5% are really only just thinking about it, and that maybe 1% of them are actually doing something.
I'm not taking that percentage. I'm not going to go out there with a percentage. I'm sorry.
I didn't say how much I was going to bet
yet.
Ma'am. They wanted you to be a reference customer, and so when you bitched and complained and said, they jumped. Well, they're young businesses, and that's something you can use as leverage. Is if you're a big established company and you really want to use the ASP.
I'm not sure if this side of the room heard what this woman just shared with us, but she said that they are using an ASP, and they looked at the security policy, and then they went in to actually validate that the policy was being adhered to, and they found very scary things. They did find the doors propped open. They did find passwords taped up on monitors, and So she was just validating that's exactly what happened. But since they wanted them as a reference customer, they did snap to and change and address the
there
issues.
There was one question or comment from here.
Do you find the ASPs outsourcing their security?
The ASPs outsourcing their security?
Yes.
Yes. And then, of course, you have to worry about who... I mean, this is the and they told two friends problem. It's I'm outsourcing to you. What are you outsourcing?
Right.
And, you know, we're becoming this interconnected web of everyone outsourcing to everyone else so that no one actually has to do anything. And and that's a problem. It is a problem because you have not only are you trusting the ASP, you're trusting all the decisions that they have made about the security of things that they are outsourcing, including their security. And, you know, I have a bee in my bonnet about outsourcing security as well, so as you may have guessed.
But you are an outsourced.
In that way.
so back to how are their policies enforced? This because we've already touched on a lot of these points. You know, are they doing the audits? Are they getting the seals of approval? As we said, it's not a silver bullet. If they were audited last year, that's not going to save them this year. It was aged the second the auditor left. But you know, are they adhering to some sort of an audit and getting themselves checked off against a third party? And basically, again, not that they're bad. It's just it's forest for the trees. You need to have somebody from outside their company take a look at their procedures and policies to make sure that they really are doing what they think they're doing.
If you were educated in the U.S. school system, just think checks and balances and you'll be fine. If you weren't educated in the U.S. school system, that phrase probably doesn't mean anything to you.
There's a reason that the House and the Congress are there, right?
Yeah, the separation of powers is what it's really about, and trying to make sure that people say they're doing things and they're really serious about it and they're really making a hard effort, but someone needs to come along and confirm that they're really doing that who has your interests at heart and not theirs.
Right, and also, are they logging? Can you go back and look? Can you monitor what happened? Take a look at what kind of logs they're keeping and if you have access to them.
And
if not, why not? See if they can, some companies will have, they're servicing many, many customers, obviously, so some of the logs may be a little sensitive information. See if you can get a listing of your own log information, if they give you any problem about looking at the logs, because I have heard, well, but there are other customer information on that log. Okay, fine. But the customer needs to be able to sort through their own logs. And you might want to have those printed out to you, sent in a nice, you know, think of the telecom. They do a really good job of basically giving you a log of all your phone calls, and they'll slice it and dice it any way you want it, and you should be able to get some sort of intelligent log reporting from your ASP, too.
Because you may notice trends and things in your own log information that you get from the ASP. You may choose to process those logs and look for your own problems, like, oh, Marianne is logging in. Someone forgot to delete her account when she was fired.
Right.
And that's your responsibility, not theirs. They don't know Marianne was fired, and they don't want to know. Moving right along, the next few slides are about the actual application hosting design. What the ASP did when they were designing the architecture, designing the application, if the application is custom, and how they approached that purely from a security point of view. I mean, it unfortunately, when you look at it, or fortunately when you look at it, you have to look at it in a holistic picture. But security, you want to see that security was built in from the start, that they didn't tack it on, that they did all the right things, in quotes. What's their philosophy? What's their strategy?
Right, and if you have an in-house architect, security architect, you might want to have them take a look at this. But, you know, there are people out there who honestly believe that, well, you ask them, what's your security, what's the architecture, and they say, we're secure. We have a firewall, and we use SSL to the web server.
Yes.
I'd like to make a quick comment. I was interested in brought this up because I've been doing security for about 7 years now, and I got into this type of financial creative company that was doing hosting the different ISP. My work as a security engineer got so complex because no security was built in the ground up,
right,
into the infrastructure, and I had to leave the company. So
right.
Yeah, he's talking about
the very
strong, that anybody who's been doing security for a long time, the frustration and the difficulty of the bolt-on, the afterthoughtedness of integrating security rather than building it from the ground up as a system, you know, the true systemic design. So yeah, ask them, what is their philosophy? Because if their philosophy is, well, we'll just bolt it on at the end, or yeah, we're secure, we have a firewall. It's probably not the philosophy that you have within your organization.
I speak a lot about using systems engineering techniques for security, and that's something that both Diana and I have a lot of interest in. And it's very interesting. I mean, the analogy to take away, the thing to hold in your mind, is if you want a three-bedroom house, would you rather have a three-bedroom house that was built with three bedrooms from the beginning, or would you rather have a two-bedroom house that someone put an extension on? And, you know, it's not quite a good comparison, but it's a good thing to think about. It's like, would you like a hole that was designed from the beginning, or would you like something where someone came and slapped on a thing with a tin roof at the end?
Yeah, I think maybe better than the room, because I'm sure many people have nice additions on their house.
Yeah, I don't want to diss your contractors.
Would you like a house that didn't have running water, and then they added the pipes after they had built the entire house? I mean, imagine what a messy, yucky thing that. You want the pipes in the walls and running. You don't want them added on after the rest of the house is built.
And anyone who's ever run cables knows how easy it is to put them in before you start.
Yeah, there you go.
And
that's
difficult
a great
it is
one.
To
yeah.
have the, to have the guys come and run the cables through the walls after the walls have been built.
Yeah.
There are a number of things, a number of red flags and to watch for while you're thinking about this. The first one is that there are problems with shared servers. If the application, we'll get to the application design itself in a while, but if the application is not properly constructed and your data is on a server that's being shared with other people, there may be very easy ways that your competitors who are using the same outsourcing service as you, the same ASP as you, because it meets both your business needs, have their data on the same server as you, and they just fudge the URL or whatever, and they're into your data because it's on the same server.
And
now, some of the companies will let you actually specify, I need my own server, but they're going to charge you more for it.
And this is a nasty, nasty case of history repeating itself. Anybody who was doing security and helping the ISPs setting up their architectures years ago, you saw a lot of this out there. They would put up a web server that 100 people had access to, and it turned out that you had, especially when people were using some of the new tools that were out, and some of them were particularly flawed, like the front page server extensions, all of a sudden, great, you could post to any of those 100 websites that were on that server. And we're seeing that again with the, unfortunately, people are, we keep relearning lessons in this world, and people are relearning that one. I'm sorry, there's a question over there. Yeah.
That maybe has some experience in security.
You mean the ASP?
The ASP. Just because they have some experience in the security world, perhaps, or whatever you're going to have to do, not assume that they answer these questions.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. She said just because a company does have longevity, as Ian said, it doesn't mean that they have answered these questions. So don't, they may seem a kind of, like, well, gee, don't they think about this? Isn't this, their whole purpose? And like, no, a lot of them really haven't. So don't assume. That's a great point. Don't assume because they've been around that they've done this.
Yeah.
Let's make a comment about audit.
About audit?
About audit.
Yeah.
Yes.
And at this point, I think in the security field, for the most part, people understand host-level access control, how to secure an operating system to a certain extent, and network topology and other science from network topology can do this reasonably well. But scrutinizing the application logic and looking at each individual application, which when they go into a site, it's a completely different application.
Right.
His point. The comment here was a lot of people have kind of nailed down the basic network topology, the base host level access security, but now that we're getting into application design and application logic, we're seeing a lot more problems and vulnerabilities creeping up.
You can certainly put a totally insecure application on a totally secure operating system and be very well screwed.
Right. Yeah. It's true.
And then you can get
right.
Or whoever said, yeah, we did our job.
Right. Well, when people say we did our job securing the system, it's your job to turn around and say, well, what was that job? What did you actually do, and what were you thinking about when you did it? We're gonna move on because we're running a little behind. Physical and network security. This is another much overlooked thing. People understand they need to actually secure the server that they've got this stuff on, but they don't truly understand how physically secure you might want their facility to be. This is the propped open doors problem.
Right. Right. Yeah. And also, and really take it. And it depends on the level of security you're looking for. I mean, if you're not doing something that's really highly sensitive in your company, or this isn't highly sensitive data that the ASP is dealing with, you may not be as concerned. But if this is extremely highly sensitive proprietary data, you might want to get somebody who understands physical auditing to come in and take a look at their facility. A good example is that a lot of times when I was auditing financial services and brokerage houses, they'd have these really good locked down server rooms. And what we were doing, and people got smarter finally, and the raised floors and all the right air conditioning, and you had to do, sometimes biometrics to get in. It was always two-factor authentication with keys and pads, and there was somebody watching you get in the room. Well, and the ceiling went all the way, the walls went all the way up to the ceiling. The problem was the ceiling was a drop ceiling. So you could climb up, punch out the acoustic tile and crawl right over the wall and get into this room that had all these locks and measures
this
and things
the,
like that. You know, that's the kind of thing that, depending on the sensitivity that you have with this information, you may really want to have their facility physically audited.
It's the new version of in the 19th century where they used to send small boys up chimneys to clean them. Now security companies hire small boys to crawl through ceilings and break into computer rooms. The other part of this, oh, sorry, are you going to talk?
No, I was going to say your cats.
We just oh, cats. Yeah, we've got trained
cameras
cats.
On cats. Yeah.
Or cockroaches. The other component of this is what kind of application are they actually hosting? You know, are you buying access to an expensive application like SAP that you don't want to implement, or are you buying access to an application that they have specifically designed for a special purpose? And we're going to come back to this because we've got some more slides on this, so I'm going to move us along.
Oh, we do? Because there's good stuff to say. Okay.
Well, here we go. This is part of the, is it a commercial application? Is it commercial off-the-shelf software? Is it COTS or is
COTS
it
mean?
Homegrown? If it's COTS, if it's something that they went out and bought, let's say they go out and buy SAP and they deal with all the horrendous documentation and they torture themselves with all of the horrendous problems of setting up an SAP system, and they provide you with a really great interface to it that's mostly web-based and you're really happy with it, and a security problem is found by the ASP, can they get it fixed? Can they speak German? Do they know how to talk to SAP and actually talk to an engineer and get the problem fixed in a reasonable time frame? Are they smart enough to be able to work around the problem? Are they prepared to disable a part of their service because there's a serious security problem? How much control do they have over the software? The same questions apply if you're using COTS software yourself, and they're very difficult questions and there are no really good answers to them.
And in some ways this is really a plus for the ASPs if you're going with a big, you know, 5,000-pound gorilla COTS solution like a Bon or a PeopleSoft or an SAP, because if you're a small company, you could call up PeopleSoft and say, hey, found a problem, and they're like, yeah, we care. You know, you're a small client and you're not important. But if the SAP has a lot of clients, they become a very large and important client to that COTS vendor, so all of a sudden you may have more leverage through them because you're important to them and they're important to SAP or to PeopleSoft.
Leverage is good when it comes to off-the-shelf software. The more you can get, the better. There's also a question of vendor reliability, but it's all part of the same thing. It's like you just need to consider, this is the same as are the ASP outsourcing stuff. In this case, they've effectively outsourced the development and security of the software to someone else. Is that someone you trust?
Right. You're making two decisions now. You're making the decision on what is that software going to be. Is it going to be PeopleSoft, Bon, SAP? And then you're also making the decision, is this ASP the right one to implement that solution for me?
Of course, the opposite, the other approach has just as many problems. If they're homegrown applications, were they built with security in mind? Did they build with security from the ground up, or did they just sort of go to the technical equivalent of Sears when the application was done? How often do they modify the application, and what's their change control process for that? Do they do quality assurance? Do they have a test plan? How do you know that they're not going to put something up, and we've been through all this already, they're not going to change the application on a Sunday, and you come in on Monday morning, and unbeknown to you, there are now serious security problems in the application, because they had no quality control, and some engineer came in on the weekend and decided to fix something. You need to worry about their software development process. There are a lot of opportunities for error in this.
Yeah, and again, this is something, if you don't have the experience in-house and this, and you really need to make sure that this is secure, this where your data is, get somebody from outside to help you out with it, to take a look. I've seen bizarre things, like people storing administrator usernames and passwords, you know, in a regular old, you know, registry key. That's it. Unencrypted. Nothing
this
at all
is
like
one
that.
Of the things
or
that,
in scripting, you'll see username, passwords in a scripting file on a web server. I mean, again, unencrypted. Or a golden login to the back end that's an SA admin to a database. You don't want that kind of NSA admin, is, if you don't know, is
suffice it to say it's bad.
Yeah, so you don't want, there are some very huge holes. What I just described are all ways that somebody could get in and run through your data from the ASP, and it's not necessarily that they may just not have thought through or understood the security implications of it. So get somebody to take a look at their code, to take a look at their security and
how
they're storing.
Of course, the same problems exist in off-the-shelf software as well. So You know, it's kind of Hobson's choice to use an English phrase. You can choose something awful or something else awful, and it's not really a choice at all in some ways. But you do need to think about it. There was a hand in the back there.
Yeah.
All the same things in your job apply. They don't have any policies. They don't have a very nice setup. They keep asking, you know, would you store your data on our side?
Right.
I just feel that I'm a director of this company for information system. I just feel, why would we do that at all? Do you see the trend moving that way?
What you're saying, the ultimate question is, are ASPs a trend where
right.
people are putting data onto these things and it's going to continue, or are they a fad? Right. You want to do it in-house in order to... It's not completely clear right now. A lot of these things, to me at least, a lot of these things come and go. I mean, I've actually seen a similar process with web servers. People, initially, they were outsourcing their web content, putting it on a hosting service. Then they pulled it back in-house because the hosting services weren't good enough and they needed to control it more. Then they put it back out because the hosting services improved. Then they pulled it back in because they're doing e-commerce and they're not sure about what the security implications are. Now the hosting services are saying that they do e-commerce and they're pushing it back out again. I think we've got to go around and around this spiral a few more times before we end up with something. I think with ASPs, my opinion, and Diana, I'm sure, will give you hers as well, is that some people are, we're going to end up in a balance here where people who take it seriously, take data security seriously, are going to ask themselves a lot of questions, and then they're going to make a decision based on business goals. So when the business goals versus the security needs for the data fit in a certain pattern, they will go with an ASP and all that means. And when they don't, they'll keep it in-house. Smaller companies will go with ASPs not because they want to, but because they have to, because they want access to things that they can't otherwise get. Larger companies will ultimately pull everything in-house and then send it out and then pull it in. I mean, I had the same thing with firewalls. I had one company I was working with. They were doing everything in-house. They were doing a really good job of it. And then suddenly one day, someone in management signed a contract with a large ISP to outsource their security and completely screwed them up for about 3 months. And then after that, they were happy. Now they're thinking about pulling it all back in-house again. So, you know, and they've got a lot of money so they can afford to do it because they're a big, big company. But smaller companies, I think, are going to tend towards ASPs. It's not clear to me. I think some of the ASPs are going after large companies. But they may actually make a lot more money long term by going after small companies because they're the ones who really can't afford to do this themselves.
That's very true. I mean, there are always companies have cultures and certain cultures believe in certain things. You know, some companies outsource everything. There's one brokerage firm that wrote its own browser, which I'll never get over. I mean, why would anybody write a web browser? But they believe in doing everything homegrown. Okay, that's their culture. So there are some cultures that are going to outsource, some are going to keep it inside. But generally, and the trend is going to go one way or another. Right now, the big trend is, yeah, definitely send everything out. But I think ultimately the play is going to be with
right.
the small to mid-sized companies. It's going to be a size and skills issue. Small to mid-sized companies are going to get a cost benefit about going with the ASPs. The larger companies have the resources to bring it in-house.
Law firms are really interesting. I mean, you'd think law firms would want control of everything because of all the data they have and the possibility of getting sued and everything else. And they're all going on an outsourcing frenzy right now. I don't know how long that's going to last. We were touching on code reviews before. Code reviews are a good thing, capital G, capital T. In a general sense, they're a good thing because they improve the quality of code. What we're talking about is security code reviews, where people look specifically for security problems that are known to be a problem for programmers, like buffer overflows. You know, some huge percentage of all exploits that people use are based around buffer overflows. And this is something we've known about for years, and there are still people out there today, right now, as we sit here, writing code with buffer overflows in it.
There will always be people.
I know. There will always be people doing this because each generation forgets all the mistakes of the previous one.
Yeah, we're not good at gathering around the fire and spreading
this. This is why we had to have two
community.
World wars instead of just one.
Right.
That that's crazy.
Oh dear, yeah, that one bears repeating.
This gentleman said that he knows of a professor that actually wrote some example code on a board in a class that had a buffer overflow in it, and fought with the student that corrected him. The next point, it sounds kind of redundant, but was the review independent? A lot of people are doing code reviews, but they're doing them in-house with their group. And again, if you've ever proofread a paper before you've handed it in, or an article before you submit it into a magazine, you'll miss mistakes because your eye is used to what's supposed to be there. So you'll read what's right rather than what's wrong. That happens very often with code.
I have two other words that go along with that: peer pressure. In-house reviews can be good, but if there's no independence between the reviewer and the author, and one of them is the manager of the other, read everything into that you want to, but peer pressure is a big problem in security.
Yep.
And also, how often do they do this over again, given that they're changing their code every 20 minutes?
Right, and there's a question here.
Hi. The question is, among those companies you find that have documented security policies, do you find that they put the code review in the security policies, or is it something largely
The question was, among the, I'll paraphrase it, among the minuscule fraction of people that have security policies, do they actually include code review in their policy? I don't think I've ever seen a policy that included a requirement for code review.
No, I mean, there are different levels of policies at enterprise and at companies, and usually there's an overarching policy that you'll see that is not in the least bit technical, and then you'll get more into lines of business, into particular, striated stovepipe policies. But the code review itself may be at some low level policy, but never in one. I've never seen it in a broad.
I have. There's someone over there.
There's one out there.
Have we ever seen a book on how to write a good security policy? There are actually several.
Yeah.
We should talk afterwards because
we can give you some good.
Yeah, we'll give you some references, and there are some good online things too. I can probably email you some.
Yeah, there are a couple really great online references that we can. If we don't have references, I don't think we did at this one, but we can.
No.
We can get them out to people.
Yes.
Scott Parker, Secure Network Consulting, we do policy writing.
Oh, well, if we're going to do commercials, I do policy writing for companies,
too. Talk after.
Yeah, I was trying to be non-commercial, but there are a lot of companies that will help you with it, including mine. Okay. Contingency planning is one of these things. You know, we veer a little bit away from security and the things that we're telling you to ask. There are a lot of other things you can ask ASPs that are not related to security. We worry about disaster recovery and backups because they do affect security, because they affect the availability and the security of your data. With disaster recovery, the big question is, do they do it and do they have a plan for it? With backups, I want to see off-site backups, but done in a secure way, because I don't want their facility to burn down and take my data with it, and I also don't want the tapes to go missing and take my data with it.
Right. So yeah.
The other part of contingency planning that's more security oriented is incident response. Do they have policies and procedures? We're back to the policy and procedure again. If an incident happens, and what I mean here is a security incident, what's their escalation path? How does it get handled? How is your data protected? And when do you get told what's happened?
Right. Is it going to fail open or is it going to fail closed? If somebody has gotten into their network and gotten your data, when do you find out about it? When do they find out about it? And what's going to be done about it? Is this thing going to clamp down automatically or is it going to stay wide open? So you really need to understand how they're going to get a hold of you and when and
or if. In some cases, people have security incidents. They've got your data, and even if you've told them time and again that you really want to know, they won't tell you because they're afraid you're going to yank your service or whatever else. You need to know if there was an incident because you need to be able to assess your risk. And a lot of people don't want to talk about it. It's a natural human thing.
Right. And again, it's, very much, we saw a lot of this with the ISPs. Some of the ISPs learned, some of them didn't. And the ASPs,
and
unfortunately, are now. Because, the thing with ASPs is that they're doing really neat business things, and it's all a charge to get real estate and to get people. And security is still seen as a blocker. So security is the thing that's going to slow things down and make things not happen quick enough. And they're out there to grab the real estate and grab the business as quickly as possible. And that's a good thing. It makes a lot of sense. But it's time now to take a look at the security issues.
This again is not strictly directly. It's the question over here.
I just was wondering, how do you find out if they are telling you you're compromised? I don't see how you would ever sort that out.
Well, when your competitor all of a sudden jumps the gun and gets your product that was secret out before you, that would be a good indicator. No, seriously, it's very hard. I would say again, you know the old thing about Bruce Schneier is always saying it's hard to tell good security. Good security looks just like bad security, right? And there is something, a chicken or an egg problem with this. I would say if your provider is not open with you about what their policies are, how they're going to tell you what's going on, if they won't let you audit them, I've been through situations where people were going to contract with an ISP or an ASP, and they refused to allow an independent Big Five audit of their systems. At that point, run away, because if they're not being open and showing you what's going on, you're not going to know, and good security and bad security can look the same.
This is part of the problem with these things, is that if they're not telling you an incident has happened and you're not comfortable with the level of trust you have in them that they would tell you when an incident has happened, then you need to evaluate whether you really want to be doing business with them at all. And that's not an easy thing, because if they have an incident you find out about it and they didn't tell you when they were supposed to, they've probably breached their contract, and I know some good lawyers. But that's a rare set of circumstances.
Yes, you had a question?
More fundamentally, do most ASPs even know that they've been breached and that your data is compromised?
That's a very good
question.
Do they know if they've been breached?
Does the ASP know that they've been breached?
Probably they don't know. Yeah. I mean, that's something else to, you know, that would be a good question to add to our list of questions is, you know, what kind of monitoring are they doing? What kind of processes do they have in place to find out that they've actually been breached? We have a slide later, actually, I think, that talks about that a little bit.
This is a big...
Yeah, PowerPoint decided that ASP meant ASP, so now they've turned into snakes. Direct pun intended. You can see we've looked at these slides dozens of times, and the proofreading failed, and we should have had an outside proofreader look at.
Right, availability. This is going to be a big. It's a business cost to you. If you can't get to your site or you can't get to your data, what's that going to cost you? Think about that.
It's not a security thing, but it's important enough. We really thought it ought to be in here, because whether it's a security incident or a mouse or an idiot administrator that takes your data down, you're going to care.
Right.
Separation safeguards. Those are always fun. We've touched on this already. This comes back to the not only what do they do with your data, but who else's data do they commingle it with? Where does it live? How is it protected not only from the world in general, but from customers of the ASP? How do they keep it separate? What do they do? And this is on all levels. This is not just what do they do in the application, or not just what do they do with the backups. It cuts across everything we've been talking about.
Right, and the employees contractor thing points out to the outsourcing of the security, right? If they're outsourcing their security, then that person has access to your data potentially. So, you know, look at everybody who touches your data. See if they can give you a flow model of who's going to touch your data and why, what level of, you know, is it the backup administrator? Can they see it? Is it the guy who's running the NOC 24/7 who's just is waiting for an incident response alarm to come up? Is it just administrators? Is it just your company? Can you make it so that only you have access to your data and actually nobody at the ASP has access to it? You know, check out how those policies
you could summarize this. You could summarize this as it's 10 o'clock. Do you know where your data is or are, depending on grammatically how you're... Yes.
Could you address the situation? We're talking about getting into this, getting into production, but there are situations where companies go belly up.
Yes.
Someone gives you a better deal. What about separating from your ASP to go internal or to go...
Right. Actually, that's another interesting aspect of data separation is the other meaning of separation. How do you extract your data from the ASP and move it somewhere else when they're lousy or when they go out of business?
Right.
And that's definitely not a security question. That's a serious question to ask yourself in general.
And
how the hell do I get it back out again?
Yeah, it's a good persistence question too. Well, you know, recently the FTC came down on eToys because eToys went belly up, and they had a privacy policy that said we will never ever ever share your personal data. Well, they went belly up, and they're Chapter 11, and they're looking any way, shape, or form that they can stay and pay off their creditors. So, lo and behold, one of the assets that they were selling off was their customer list.
And they'd written their privacy policy in such a way that they had forbidden themselves from doing it.
But now that they were bankrupt, the rules had changed. So,
and the customers weren't happy, and neither was the FTC.
Yeah, so that's been addressed, but it's a good example of how... That's a good question. You know, ask what's going to happen if this ASP belly ups.
Oh, there. Right, yeah. You know, you can go into the security equivalent of a vicious spiral, and you can go down paranoia alley, and you can get more and more and more paranoid. What you were saying, what if they sell the old system and it's got an image of my data on it? You know, what if the FBI are installing Carnivore on their network? What if? I mean, we could go on like this for a long time.
And honestly, yeah. This data is that proprietary, and you really, really got to ask yourself if you should be sending it out to an ASP.
But people are outsourcing data like that.
But if it's that, you know, if we're talking like, you know, security levels, government kind of levels.
Guess what? It's risk management.
Because you will have questions like this down the road.
It's a risk management question, and that's really what a lot of this is about. But that's really what everything in security is about.
Yes, it's not security.
Oh, it did it again! Damn it. Employee screening. This is something that's been very much on my mind lately because I just signed a contract with a customer that has an explicit clause in it that says anyone you send to us, we can do a security background check on them whenever we want, at any time, and you have to return all the money we've paid you if you don't let us. Which I was actually happy to sign because it's nice to see that people are actually putting this into their contracts. How experienced are their employees is one thing, but also who the hell are they and how do you trust them and how do they find out that, you know, you're storing your proprietary, say you're a law firm and you're storing case data and they used to work at a law firm and they still kind of work there part-time and it's one of your competitors and how do you know that they're not being paid to leach your data? This is another risk management question because you can never really, really know. But you need to know who's touching your data, which comes back to asking for a data flow model of where your data goes and who touches it.
You can't live with a big cement dome over your life, but yeah, at least ask them, are they doing reference checks? Because right now there are some companies that are in such a frenzy to hire people, and there's a huge problem with getting staff and getting people that have experience. And some companies are really going to the one end and saying, you know, they'll pretty much go off the street, grab somebody, hire them, and they're really not doing a check on their background. And if this is a sensitive kind of a material that you're storing, you would like to know, at least call a couple of references, and maybe if it's a high level security issue, you know, they have done some sort of background check
If your data is that valuable that you need to be really sure about this, don't outsource it.
Right, just balance it.
Oh, you've got three minor felonies all in fraud? Oh, no problem. Come in and work for us.
Some companies are not checking references on people coming into their organization because they are so desperate to get people on site. And
My cousin's sister's dog walker recommended this person, so they must be fine.
Right.
I mean, we've really gotten to that situation in a lot of cases because the market's so tight.
Be sane, but at least make sure they're checking them out a little bit.
So now comes the $64,000 question, which is, what should ASPs be doing? What should they do? Well, let's put an ASP hat on to prove that we're not just here to rag on ASPs. ASPs should cover themselves. They should get insurance. Because even the fact that you go out and you get liability insurance and other kinds of insurance shows good faith. It says, we realize that there are situations in which we can screw up, but we're giving you a way to get a financial benefit from that, even though we're not going to be very happy about it. It's a good faith thing.
Right. I mean, in ASP, you can't be perfect. You're not going to be able to do an absolutely perfect job of protecting everybody's data. There's going to be some flaw in some software that you're running that has nothing to do with what you've done or not doing your due diligence or anything out of form. And if a client decides to go after you legally, because there's not a lot of precedence about who's going to take the liability in the digital world, this is really interesting stuff that's being established, but you could be at risk. So make sure you're insured and make sure you're following the procedures that would keep you from being liable.
There's no such thing, as everybody here I hope has heard before, as 100% security. So consequently, mistakes will happen, problems will happen, but you want them to happen in a way that's manageable and in a way that ultimately, if you are in front of a jury of people who don't understand security or anything else to do with technology, that they will at least say, well, these people were taking it very seriously. They were being conscientious. They weren't reckless. Because then the amount of money that you end up having to pay won't be so much.
Yeah, they acted in due faith.
And your liability insurance will cover it. It's sad, but it's true. I mean, we're a very legalistic society in the U.S., and this is a little different in international markets. But things are you know, they'll sue you in a U.S. court if you're in the U.S. because they know they'll get more money. So
yeah, and we're not lawyers, so we can't give you too much advice other than please go talk to lawyers when you're writing.
Now, we know some lawyers that
get
we can
ready to be sued because you may well be if you're hosting people's data and you know.
Another part of this.
Your site goes down.
Another part of this is really the same thing. Take security seriously and do it right. Do it well. Because that, again, I mean, it's partially a cover your ass thing, but as we, on the next slide, you know, it's partially a marketing thing, too. Prepare to be sued. There will be major ASP lawsuits. I'm taking bets on that, too. Now that I'm in Nevada, I can make book
I'll
again.
Take that bet with you.
Okay. This was what I was just talking about before I knocked my chair off the podium. Security as marketing. This is something actually that we've been preaching, we at Jaboa have been preaching for a long time, which is if you do security and you do it right and you're in an industry where you're protecting your data, you can use it to beat up your competitors. But if you do use it to beat up your competitors, you better have done it right because they may not be very scrupulous, if that's a word, and they may go out and hire someone to try and test what you're saying. Now that would be illegal, but that doesn't stop them from doing it. Depending on what the people do.
Right. Yeah.
So, you know, do the things we describe and do a lot more than that and take it seriously, and then you can use it as a marketing tool.
And we've seen a model for that in privacy. You know, some of the credit card companies now are marketing is, hey, sign up with us and you won't get tons and tons of junk mail because we're not going to resell your name. So, you know, also using security and privacy as a marketing tool is going to be a good differentiator in, as the market begins to really crowd up and people stop being able to figure out what's
we actually from some of the other things that we do jointly and separately, people are starting to take security a lot more seriously. Customers are starting to ask more about it. This is a good thing, again with a capital G and a capital T, and it is a differentiator in certain industries and certain markets right now. So if you're not thinking about that and you're an ASP, you should be thinking about it.
Yeah.
And I'll say it again because we've said it already, take security seriously. Consider it to be a core goal and put it in the list of things that you do at the beginning when you're writing your business plan instead of at the end when you suddenly realize you thought you ought to have had it.
Right.
What should customers do? This is our last slide. This is probably you've guessed this by now. Ask very hard questions. Don't be shy. Don't be afraid. It's your data, not theirs. Here's the we're not a lawyer, but we play one on TV thing. Get everything in writing. If they say, oh, yeah, we get audits all the time, make sure you have something in writing that says that they do, preferably in your contract.
Yeah, because if you have to go to protect yourself, if it's not in writing, you say, well, they said they backed it up 4 times a week. You know, oh, but they say, oh, we only back up once a week. You know, anything that's not in writing is a potential hole. And it's going to protect also from the ASP side. It protects them, too, because they say, here in black and white is what I said I was going to do, and I didn't overpromise. I actually delivered what I said I would deliver. So it protects both sides of the equation. You know, and get assurance about the availability, the coverage, all the SLA information I would just get in writing. And on the customer side, get yourself some insurance, too, because if it is a breach on the ASP side and you have lost business, and if you're a small business, that could mean a big difference to your bottom line. You make sure that someone's out there to
if you're a small business, when you're going out of business because of a mistake that was made by your ASP, you'll be very glad you did all of this.
So that gives us some, we have 15 minutes to lunch. If anybody has questions, we'll open the floor for questions.